Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, where performance is driven by original fundamental research on a global scale. This is Putnam Today. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Lame ducks and tax cuts are all the rage in Washington, where that $250,000 threshold came from. Turns out Facebook wants even more of your time, and how good branding can make all the difference. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by the all-new Chevrolet Volt, available soon in select markets. Details at ChevyVolt.com. The all-new Chevrolet Volt, it's more car than electric. And by Progressive Insurance, helping people shop for car insurance at 1-800-PROGRESSIVE and Progressive.com.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Ryssdal. It is Monday today, everybody, the 15th of November. Good, as always, to have you with us. Members of the lame duck 111th Congress have gathered in Washington for a final few weeks of legislating. They'll wrap up whatever loose ends there are, the loosest of which are the Bush-era tax cuts. There are, technically, two sets of those tax cuts passed in 2001 and 2003. Both of them expire in about 6 weeks, right at the end of the year. President Obama and a lot of Democrats want to make lower rates permanent for low and middle income families, but they want to let the cuts for families earning $250,000 a year or more expire. Other than that, it's a nice round number, though, $250,000. Why'd they draw the line at $250,000 a year anyway? Our Washington Bureau Chief John Dimsdale explains.
Every taxpayer benefited from the Bush cuts. For most middle-income Americans this year, those tax cuts will add less than $1,000 to their after-tax income, according to the Tax Policy Center. But for people in the top 0.1% of income, those who take in more than $2.2 million a year, the Bush tax cuts mean an average $500,000 windfall. Cornell economics professor Robert Frank says the Bush tax cuts increase the nation's income inequality.
The higher you go up the income ladder, the bigger the savings are for the wealthy taxpayers.
That's because income taxes take a relatively small bite from middle-income families. They pay proportionally larger payroll taxes for Social Security and Medicare, as well as sales taxes and property taxes. Wealthy people pay a bigger percentage in income and capital gains, and those were the rates that went down during the Bush years. John Podesta, the president of the Center for American Progress, says the Obama administration is trying to reverse favoritism for the rich.
President Bush's obsession with just taking care of the very wealthiest Americans proved not only to be unfair, which I think it is, but it proved to be weak in terms of the economy that it actually produced.
Income for the very wealthy went up 6% or more every year during the Bush years, while he says middle-income earners lost ground. Economist Martin Sullivan with Tax Analysts says by increasing income tax rates on families earning more than $250,000 a year, President Obama keeps tax cuts for 98% of all families and raises $700 billion in revenue over the next 10 years.
I think what he is looking at is an enormous budget deficit, and he's saying, well, how can we best handle this? And when you look on the tax side, those who would suffer comparatively the least are the wealthy.
Sullivan says extending the tax cuts for the rich will widen an income gap that's been growing for 30 years. In Washington, I'm John Dimsdale for Marketplace.
The Commerce Department released some eye-popping retail sales figures for October this morning. Eye-popping in a good way for a change, I'm happy to say. They jumped twice as much as analysts were expecting, the biggest rise since March. A hefty chunk of the American economy comes from consumer spending, so a strong showing in retail would normally be cause for celebration. And there was some celebrating, that is, but only to a point. Because Marketplace's Janet Babin explains seasonal adjustments can make those retail sales numbers look a little bit better than they actually might be.
Retail sales rose 1.2% last month, mostly on the strength of auto sales. But it's not like car dealers were suddenly clearing every car off the lot. It's just that sales didn't fall as much as they normally do in October. And compared to where we've been the past few seasons, that makes the seasonal retail figure look higher. Mark Vittner is a senior economist at Wells Fargo.
We fell so hard that any rebound looks relatively large in percentage terms. But it's simply that we're bouncing from such a huge fall.
Retail sales figures that exclude things like cars, food, and gas were still encouraging, but rose a more modest 0.4%. Economists exclude the prices of those things because they tend to bounce around a lot and can end up distorting the numbers. That said, Harvard Business School professor John Quelch says car purchases will do more to boost the economy than, say, clothing sales.
Cars require more services to be provided with them when they're new and in use.
Someone to finance the car, someone to maintain it, or worst-case scenario, to fix it. But no matter what the purchase, from durable goods like cars to a snow globe stocking stuffer, shoppers still expect bargains as good as they might normally find on Christmas Eve. Retail strategist John Long with Kurt Salmon Associates calls it holiday creep.
While sales and promotions in past years have waited until the week of Thanksgiving or even Black Friday, they happened earlier this year in the month of November as enticements to get the best deals.
And that will keep up pressure on many retailers' bottom lines. In New York, I'm Janet Babin for Marketplace.
If you happen to be planning to fly at Thanksgiving, and about 24 million of us are planning to, expect security lines to be a little bit longer, maybe a lot longer. Concerns about those full body scanners are increasing, as our senior business correspondent Bob Moon is here to explain to us. Hey, Bob.
Hey, Kai.
Security at airports, as we all know, is never fun, but this is something different.
That's right. Critics of these new security methods complain the government has stepped over the line to being what one group calls extremely voyeuristic. Some civil liberties activists have already gone to court, in fact, challenging these high-tech full-body scanners. You may have already heard complaints they can virtually strip search you, although the TSA insists those images won't be misused. The agency also promises they're completely safe, although experts from several universities are on record challenging that. They fear the so-called backscatter X-rays could produce enough radiation to cause a measurable, albeit a very slight, risk of cancer.
You do have a choice, though, right? You can say you don't want to be scanned.
Well, this is where the balance between safety and privacy becomes quite literally extremely delicate. Travelers can opt out of the scanners, but at that point they must submit to what the TSA calls a pat-down. It's actually become much more aggressive lately. It routinely involves touching of all the private parts.
You said must submit.
That's right. Consider an incident just this past weekend at San Diego's Lindbergh Airport. A 31-year-old traveler named John Tyner was headed to South Dakota with his father-in-law for a hunting trip. Tyner had read some of the security checkpoint complaints out there, so he left his iPhone recorder on as he went through security. He declined both the scanner and the pat-down, and if you listen carefully to his video on YouTube, this is where a supervisor was brought in and told him it was either that or he could not travel.
If you're not comfortable with that, we can escort you back out and you don't have to fly today.
Okay, I don't understand how a sexual assault can be made a condition of my flying.
This is not considered a sexual assault.
It would be if you weren't the government.
Well, he was eventually allowed to return to the ticket counter, where after some discussion, American Airlines agreed to refund his non-refundable fare. But someone he believed to be a TSA official then approached him before he left the airport and told him a civil suit would be filed against him for refusing to complete his screening, and he could face a $10,000 fine. He left anyway.
Just to be clear, this guy Tyner would have been fine with the metal detector, right? The old-fashioned way, but it's these scanners that he objects to.
Yeah, he said there were lots of passengers going through the metal detectors, yeah. But they wouldn't let him.
Yeah. Do we know whether he's been sued?
Well, the TSA tells us it can't comment on pending investigations, but it does say anyone refusing to complete screening could be subject to a civil penalty. It cites here a ruling from the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals that allowing people not to go through with screening would give terrorists multiple opportunities to try penetrating security until they could find a vulnerability.
Yeah. One of the reasons we're talking about this is that it's holiday travel season, Thanksgiving's coming up, and there's a little bit of a groundswell here about these new procedures.
There is several different camps are lining up against this stepped-up screening. The union, representing more than 5,000 U.S. Airways pilots, is now urging them to refuse to submit to the full-body scanners. Leaders of the travel industry met with the chief of Homeland Security late last week. They emerged saying they're still worried they're losing billions a year in lost fares from travelers weary of all this security. And there's a grassroots internet campaign at WeWon'tFly.com advocating a national opt-out day for November 24th, the day before Thanksgiving. This morning, TSA Chief John Pistole voiced his worries about that on NBC's Today Show.
I think it's irresponsible to say, let's opt out and not go try to go through any type of security screening or something that would cause terrific delays, significant delays at the airport on the busiest travel days and season of the year.
And by the way, Kai, there are 317 of these units in use at more than 65 airports across the nation, hundreds more on the way, at $150,000 a pop. and they've been mostly paid for with $25 million from economic recovery funds.
The Stimulus Act, right?
That's right.
Marketplace's Bob Moon. Thank you, Bob.
Thanks, Kai.
As far as Wall Street went today, forget equities, folks. Watch the bond market instead. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. The company that made telling you about new emails famous...
You've got mail.
...is trying to get back in the game. AOL launched a new email product over the weekend. Unfortunately for them, admitting you have an AOL email address isn't all that far from saying you still use a modem and dial-up internet connections, which is why AOL's share of the email market is fading fast. On the contrary, the real email news of the day is more social. Facebook, with its 500 million-odd users, rolled out a new messaging platform today. We've got Marketplace's Steve Henn on the line with more on that. Hey, Steve.
Hey.
So this thing Facebook rolled out today, this communications suite, I suppose. Tell us about it. What is it?
Well, basically, they decided that with text messages, IM, email, you know, Facebook messaging, that folks were spending a lot of time keeping track of how their friends actually interacted online and then trying to send messages to their friends and trying to remember who they talked to. And they just wanted to make that all simpler and easier. And so this is how Mark Zuckerberg, the CEO of Facebook, describes the system.
We wanted to make it so that it's super simple. You have a conversation with a person or with a group of people. You have one conversation with that group or that person, and all your IMs, messages, emails, SMSs go into that, and you have one history, and you can kind of go through it forever, right? And that's going to be really cool.
So my reaction today when I heard about this, Steve, was, yeah, you know, Facebook has email, so what? But then it occurred to me that it's probably not about people like me, right?
No, it's absolutely not. It's not about me either. You know, when Zuckerberg first introduced this, he did it by talking to high school students about how they communicate, how they send each other messages online. And he realized that they just didn't use email at all. And the reason they didn't was it was too slow, which, you know, kind of blew his mind because it's instantaneous. But what he decided they meant by that was there was just too much stuff involved in sending an email. You need a subject line, you need an email address. And he wanted to build email into something that's a lot more like instant messaging. So you click on someone's name, you write them a message, and it pops up in their inbox, no matter what kind of inbox they happen to be using.
Make the business case for me, Steve. This is really all about getting people to stay on Facebook longer, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And it's also about them building a more accurate social graph, right? That's their map of who your friends are and what they like and what you like. Right now, if you communicate with some people on email and some people on text message and some people on Facebook, they're only capturing a little sliver of your social life. They want it all, right? So
that brings up actually a joke I heard this morning. It said the guy who was telling the joke said it's going to be just like Gmail, except everybody's going to be able to see your inbox. I mean, Facebook has some credibility and some privacy issues.
Well, yeah. And I think that's going to be a big hurdle for them in getting people to switch from Gmail or Yahoo to, you know, Facebook.com as an email address. And I think it's kind of interesting the way they're going about it, right? They're not rolling this out for everybody right now. And I don't think it's because technologically they're not ready. What they're doing instead, though, is to send out invites. And, you know, I think that they want to make a Facebook email address a bit of a status symbol. You have to be invited to join, and then you have to invite your friends to join. And they're betting that this will become a viral social marketing hit. Who better to place that bet than Facebook?
Marketplace's Steve Henn on the Facebook announcement today. Thanks, Steve.
Sure thing.
Aside from the fact that you're paid to do it, there aren't usually all that many upsides to business travel. Even work trips to fun places involve lonely hours in airports and rental cars and dealing with hotel rooms and all of that. So it's no wonder, really, that people sometimes need a little something to get them through. That's the premise behind our series Road Warriors. Producer Michael Raphael is bringing us the music that people listen to when they're away from home but still on the job.
I'm Kevin Ault, and I'm a physician at Emory University in Atlanta, Georgia. And my travel song is a song that I use when I come back home called Storms Are on the Ocean by June Carter Cash.
I'm going away to leave you, love. I'm going away for a while.
But I usually think of my daughters. My daughters are getting older now. One is getting ready to turn 14 and one is 11. But, you know, the very first words are, I'm going away to leave you. And so certainly when they were little, I thought about that quite a bit. There's also a verse about who's going to dress you, who's going to kiss you, who's going to take care of you while I'm gone, while I've gone these 10,000 miles that I have to travel.
Oh, who will dress your pretty little feet, and who will glove your hand? Oh, who will kiss your rosy red cheeks when I'm in a far-off land?
Probably my favorite trip was several years ago, and I was going to Istanbul. I was actually going to talk at a European meeting, and I was one of the last lecturers. And so I gave my talk, the meeting broke up, got to go see all that wonderful world history. But the next day, you know, I was on the plane and I was ready to come home.
Seen those mournful doves flying from pine to pine. A morning for their own.
There are storms on the ocean. You're a little speck and a little teeny airplane flying over the Atlantic.
The storms are on the ocean.
You're looking over this huge bank of clouds over the North Atlantic trying to get back to the southern United States to see your kids.
This world may lose its motion, love, if I could fall to thee.
That trip was probably just a few months after this collection of songs by June Carter Cash came out. This was her last recording and was produced by her son. And so that kind of cemented it, this song as my travel song.
Oh, Papa will dress my pretty little feet. And
we've got a list of Kevin's other travel favorites in the music section of our website. And while you're there, offer up your own playlist. We'd love to know what you're listening to. It's all on our homepage, marketplace.org.
When you return again. Oh, the storms are on the ocean, and the heavens may cease to be. This world may lose.
Coming up, when warm and fuzzy just isn't going to cut it.
Nobody really has an idea of what cotton is or why they should prefer it to anything else.
But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrials was able to add 9 points on this Monday, not quite 0.1%, closed at 11,201. The NASDAQ sagged 4 points, nearly 0.2%, finished at 25.13. The NASDAQ did. The S&P 500 shaved off a single point, 0.1%, wrapped things up at 11.97. Hopeful news on mergers helped keep a floor under stocks today. Caterpillar shares gained almost 1% on news it plans to buy mining equipment maker Bucyrus International for nearly $8 billion. Shares of Amazon were still suffering from last week's news that Walmart's website is going to offer free shipping on thousands of items over the holidays. Amazon shares fell 4%. Stocks turned in better results overseas. London's FTSE stepped up 0.4%. Tokyo's Nikkei added more than 1%. And you are listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by MassMutual, with financial professionals nationwide who are trained to serve the unique financial needs of their clients at massmutual.com. By the Batten Institute, advancing knowledge about entrepreneurship and innovation at the University of Virginia's Darden School of Business, www.batteninstitute.org. And by Vanguard, whose mission is to simplify investing and to help people reach their financial goals at vanguard.com/publicradio. Marketplace covers the world of economics. Are you ready for some Freakonomics? We're partnering with the team that writes about the hidden side of everything for a regular Marketplace Freakonomics story, podcast, and more. Just go to FreakonomicsRadio.com.
From the Marketplace Statebook, here's a look at events coming up Tuesday. In Washington, the Labor Department releases the Producer Price Index for October. The Federal Reserve reports on industrial production, also for October. And the Senate Banking, Housing, and Urban Affairs Committee discusses problems in mortgage servicing from modification to foreclosure. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
Welcome back to Marketplace. We're from American Public Media. My name's Kai Rizdal. Just when you thought all the politicking was over with, there is the small matter of monetary policy to grapple with. Yeah, I know. You thought the Federal Reserve was supposed to rise above the political fray, right? Or at least not be affected by it too much? Well, $600 billion does tend to concentrate the political mind. A group of congressional Republicans and conservative economists and commentators is launching an ad campaign this week about the Fed's policy of quantitative easing. They want Ben Bernanke to stop what he's already begun, trying to push down interest rates and so boost the economy. Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Genzer reports now from Washington.
This week's ad campaign is just the latest Fed fracas. This month, some Tea Party-backed candidates bashed the Fed and then got elected. Frederick Mishkin is a former Fed governor. He's now an economist at Columbia University. He says the current political pressure is unprecedented.
I've been studying the Federal Reserve now for close to 40 years, and I've never seen anything like this.
These days, the Fed is under attack from all corners, including foreign finance ministers blaming the Fed for the lower dollar. Mishkin says intense political pressure can't force the Fed to change policy, but it can lead to that perception when the Fed acts.
There are times when tough decisions have to be made, and they need to be somewhat insulated from the political process. And if, in fact, the insulation is weakened by what's happening now, that would be a real tragedy.
Mishkin says if Congress had more control over the Fed, the central bank might not be able to make the right monetary decisions at the right time. But some Fed watchers say the central bank does need some congressional oversight. The Fed was used to very little. Now it's going to have more. Ed Mrzewinski is a consumer advocate with the U.S. Public Interest Research Group.
The pendulum swung way too far in the other direction. And now the pendulum's pushing towards, well, maybe they're not as independent, and they're starting to whine.
The Fed dodged the more draconian oversight proposals in the financial reform bill, but it has to submit to one audit. Brzezinski expects to work with the Tea Party caucus in Congress to pass tougher oversight legislation. In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer for Marketplace.
Pork bellies were basically flat on the Chicago Mercantile Exchange today, $1.04 a pound, but that's not really the important part. What matters is what you think of when you think of pork. Unless I miss my guess, it's probably pork. The other white meat, one of the better commodity branding campaigns you're likely to run across out there. But way before the other white meat, there was cotton. Cotton Incorporated, the industry group that gave us the fabric of our lives, turns 40. This year, Marketplace Jennifer Collins reports that Cotton Inc. showed other commodity producers that image really does count.
Back in the 70s, cotton had a problem.
The wonderful world of wash and wear.
Synthetic fibers were moving in on cotton's territory. They were easy to care for, and cotton needed to be starched and ironed. Plus, polyester had this guy making it look good.
Get up! Get on up! Get up!
Cotton needed to fight back, so a group of growers and importers created Cotton Incorporated. The organization took a tiny cut of every bale of fiber bought or sold in the U.S. It hired a team of ad execs, and it launched a PR assault at a time when branding a commodity was virtually unheard of. Mike Stevens trades cotton futures.
There were people, I can recall, people back in the early 70s were very, very skeptical of paying this organization to do something.
But they came around. As part of the multi-million dollar campaign, Cotton Inc. created a logo, it sponsored the Olympics in 1976, and it enlisted celebrities like Barbara Walters to build its image. Here she is, talking up her Hawaiian shirt.
Cotton. Right now, I'm sure it's doing a lot to make your life comfortable. I know it's making my life comfortable today. I'm wearing cotton.
Cotton Inc. also poured money into research to create fabrics that didn't wrinkle or burn easily. And take this, James Brown.
Fabric of my life.
40 years ago, cotton had about a third of the market. Now it commands about two-thirds. Some of the growth, of course, is thanks to demand from growing economies like India and China. But 8 out of 10 Americans can identify the Cotton logo. And Cotton Inc. has set the standard for other commodities like milk and raisins, as in Got Milk and the California Raisins. But catchy music and pretty celebrities only go so far. Branding expert Rob Frankel says simply calling cotton the fabric of our lives doesn't make it so. He says Cotton Inc.'s ads need to make a stronger case for why people should choose it over other fabrics.
Nobody really has an idea of what cotton is or why they should prefer it to anything else in the way that they understand that milk is something that you drink to get calcium. They don't know why you should wear cotton.
Jonathan Sample knows why. He runs a t-shirt printing business in Los Angeles. He also lets customers come in and print their own shirts at his shop, Fresh Pressed.
Then you pick the screen up, and there it is.
An ordinary piece of fabric with a giant splash of hot pink. He says that's the kind of boost that Cotton Inc. gave to cotton.
Throwing that logo out there, made us respect it, I would say, made us value it more.
We may soon find out how much more. Cotton prices have soared recently, and clothing makers are warning they'll need to raise prices on t-shirts and jeans. That could pit cotton once again against synthetics in the battle to become the fabric of your... No, I'm not going to say it again. I'm Jennifer Collins for Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Ally Bank, offering its Raise Your Rate CD as well as an online savings account and money market account. Learn more at allybank.com. By Toyota. Toyota is sharing technology and ideas for a better world. Learn more at toyota.com/ideas for good. And by Putnam Investments, offering total return strategies designed to match your goals. This is Putnam Today. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note today, what you might call an addendum to the numbers. You know, for all the talk about quantitative easing that there has been, yes, here and elsewhere, the Fed didn't actually start spending that $600 billion till last Friday. And remember, that extra money that's getting out there is supposed to bring long-term interest rates down. Turns out, though, the bond market doesn't really care what Ben Bernanke thinks. In the 2 days that the Fed has been buying bonds, that's Friday and today, the yield on the 30-year note has actually gone up. So take that. I guess that's why you have markets, right? Anyway, that is Marketplace from American Public Media this Monday. Today, the Dow notched up 9 points, not quite a tenth of 1%. The NASDAQ slipped 4 points, nearly 0.2%. The S&P 500 trimmed a single point, about a tenth of 1%. Our producers include Avishai Artsy, Millie Jefferson, Megan Larson, and Fiona Ng. You can tune in tomorrow to the Marketplace Morning Report for the latest in business and economic news. And coming up next time on this broadcast...
You want more people putting money in the banks, or do you want more people spending money on the lottery where they only get a little piece of what they put in?
Why doing a little bit of both might actually do society some good. It's a new installment of Freakonomics Radio right here on Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Do hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like...
What is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.